This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
So good morning to all of you. Thank you for coming on this beautiful morning for Daniel's talk, Is Cycling Normal? As I'm sure you'll agree, a beautiful place to come on a Saturday morning, whether you cycled or walked or rode here. I know there's a peninsula regatta on this morning. So again, thanks for coming. Some of the friends here know me. My name is Frances Baldwin, and I'm looking after the Museum Friends. If you're not familiar with the Museum Friends, I encourage you to take a brochure and learn about the benefits of the Museum Friends. It's a vital part of our program, and we endeavour to provide engaging and unique events such as today's talk. It also allows you discounted and free entry to other talks such as our rare books tour, the nights at the museum. So to introduce Daniel today, Daniel is a senior curator in People and Environment team here at the museum. He's been at the museum since 2004 and manages the Landmarks, People and Places across Australia gallery. He's also a regular contributor to the blog and YouTube channels and has recently overseen the Freewheeling Cycling in Australia exhibition, which is currently on display at the Queensland Museum in Brisbane. So please join me in welcoming Daniel this morning.
Thanks, Frances. I noticed that the director of the museum is in the audience, my boss, so if you are happy with what you hear today, please make sure you let him know. If you're not happy, just leave quietly and forget I mentioned it. Look, thanks again for coming along to what is a slightly different talk that we do here at the museum, one where, at least from the kind of work that I've been doing, where we're looking to link our historical work, our curatorial work, with contemporary issues. You may or may not know that last year we launched the Freewheeling exhibition, which is about cycling in Australia. And that's currently in Queensland, and that we will be travelling on to Townsville, Ballarat, Wagga, Albury and Melbourne before coming back to the National Museum in 2017. But it was actually during the research that I undertook for that exhibition that I really became interested in linking that historical story with a contemporary debate and bringing the museum's particular perspective into those debates. Our research into material culture and the lived history of objects can, I think, deepen our understanding of vital issues that affect us today. Now, the inspiration for this talk, in fact, came from all places, Family Feud. You don't get to say that very often. But last month, you may remember that in this long-running game show, they posed the somewhat provocative question of what is something annoying cyclists might do. You could argue with me about whether Family Feud is an accurate barometer of community opinion in Australia, but with some trepidation, I suspect that it just might be. Of course, the implication of this particular question and the responses that the contestants had to predict is that cycling is a fringe activity, that it's illegitimate, dangerous and faintly ridiculous, certainly an activity that isn't normal. My particular favourite response is everything. I thought it was worth taking a longer view of some of these issues here and unpack some recent debates, not just to see where we stand now, but also to suggest a way forward, beyond simply calling for better roads, better infrastructure. How can we move the debate from the polemical, entrenched and often hostile argument that it has become? Now, firstly, I have to declare my bias. As I am a cyclist, I identify as a cyclist and I ride quite a lot. I ride all kinds of bikes, mountain bikes, road, recumbent, single speed, although I lack the beard so I don't qualify as a hipster. I do commuting, touring, cycle touring, long distance and racing. And slightly outside my formal role here at the museum, I would probably consider myself a bicycle advocate in that I encourage and support ideas that lead to more cycling, that encourage people to drive less, and urban design that reduces the dominance of cars. But really the main point I want to argue today is that in many ways cyclists have always had a very complex identity in Australia, an identity that has waxed and waned over the years. But I think it is in part because of that cultural complexity that has led to some of the misunderstandings and conflict that we experience today. Now, whether they have been normal, whether bicycles and cyclists have been normal, is a vexed question. Normal is a terribly imprecise word, Of course, it's a relative concept and depends on your perspective. When I set off on some of my long-distance Audax rides, my partner insists that it isn't normal to spend 8 to 10 hours a day cycling. And I suggested that perhaps sitting at a desk for 8 to 10 hours a day isn't really a normal activity either, yet most of us endure that for decades. So what I want to talk about is also the way the bicycle has been transgressive. It's an object that has broken boundaries, exceeded expectations. It's transformed perceptions of distance, time, our landscape, and, of course, our own bodies. And in different arenas, cycling has cut through and transformed ideas about what is possible physically, the shape of our cities, how we live socially and culturally. And, of course, the bicycle has had a lasting impact on women's political enfranchisement and mobility. And I'll come to that in a bit more detail later on. Now, one of the reasons I find the bicycle so fascinating is that in many ways I think it is an inherently paradoxical object. Yes, it revolutionised the way people got around, worked and socialised, yet its simplicity, economy and reliability meant that cycling very quickly became an unremarkable feature of Australian life. In many ways, it was something of a quiet revolution. So let me try and unpack the bicycle's contradictory nature a little bit more. It is difficult for us to imagine the excitement that swept the world when bicycles became affordable and more widely used from the 1890s. The world went bicycle mad, and so, of course, did Australia. Now, the fundamental reason for this revolution was that the bicycle was a technological marvel. For the first time, a person expending no more energy than walking could travel at about the same speed as a trotting horse. What's more, you didn't need to feed your bike, it didn't get tired or stroppy, and it didn't poo on the floor, which was a considerable advance. Now, contrary to popular opinion, the arrival of the motor car in the early 20th century didn't diminish our enthusiasm for cycling. In fact, the First World War re-energised opinion in favour of the bicycle and its role in developing what was known then as the national physique. Social reformers, religious leaders, and suffragists all embraced the bicycle as a conduit to a more vital, healthy and disciplined life. In a very literal sense, the bike had quickened the pace of modern life and human physiology. So this kind of dual identity emerged. On the one hand, you had people performing extraordinary feats of human endurance on the bicycle, cycling across the continent, between the cities, people like Hubert Opperman, Francis Birtles, using the bicycle to explore and settle the continent. And there were plenty of female stars, Sarah Maddox, Joyce Barry, all setting fabulous cycling records. So on the one hand, there was this matter-of-fact acceptance of the bicycle, with huge numbers using the bike as their main form of transport. The period of what I've been calling the Quiet Revolution really extended from the 1880s until the Second World War. So for at least half a century, the bike was the dominant form of transport. The important point here is that cycling was also supported in the broader culture. It was normalised and valued as an activity at all levels, from the elite to schoolboys and schoolgirls. Newspapers were full of stories about cycling, cycling products, accounts of cycling holidays, record-breaking rides and racing. Particular cultural value was placed on physical and mental stamina, hence endurance riding remained very popular in these decades. This is an idea I'll keep coming back to. The idea of a broader cultural acceptance and promotion. Now, this is a terrific quote, which I think really captures this idea that there was a very a gentle revolution going on in Australian society. But this is not to say that the spread of the bicycle across the country was without conflict. As cycling was taken up, I think we can see that they were starting to head for a cultural crash. And it wasn't with the motor car, as I mentioned earlier. It was with the dominant form of transport at the time, the horse. I'll tell you a story that I came across during my research. And it was a story of a doctor from Melbourne who, in 1889, found himself with a spare fortnight. And he was a keen bike rider. He decided he would take his bike on the train to Sail in East Gippsland in Victoria, and from there he would cycle to Sydney, following the coast as closely as possible. These kinds of journeys were not unusual in the late 19th century. Now, on the first day of riding, when he approached Bairnsdale, a horse-drawn buggy approached from the opposite direction. He noticed that the horse was appearing to grow restless. The woman driver of the buggy yelled at Thorn to get off his bicycle. He dutifully did, and slowly approached the horse, leading his bike past it. As he did so, she shouted at the good doctor, in what he described as an absurd manner. The government, she raged, should not allow those things on the road. Thorn retorted that she should learn to drive before taking charge of a horse. He then left the scene, as he said, to be followed by a torrent of abuse. Further on to his journey, Thorn quickly realised that his bicycle was faster than riding a horse, and this was something that many dedicated horse riders around him found difficult to accept. After crossing into New South Wales and going up a particularly steep and rocky section of path, a party of horsemen overtook him and chuckled at him on his strange contraption. But once Thorn reached the summit, he decided he would let his bicycle rip and charge past the horses, startling them in a way he believed they would not soon forget. It seems that our respectable doctor did have something of the lycra-clad weekend warrior in him after all. But you can see, I think, in this tale, the seeds of a bigger clash, one that is with us today, that road rage is nothing new and just another incarnation of a complex cultural debate about who has legitimacy on the roads, and a more deeply a debate about the way humans should move, and that this has been going on for a very long time. But despite these particular altercations, bikes and horses coexisted for over half a century in cities and country towns. Indeed, it wasn't really until the 1940s, and then more seriously in the post-Second World War economic boom, that mass car ownership really took off. It was then you started to see a more direct, and in many cases literal, clash between cyclists and cars. I've been endeavouring to do some statistical research on this history, but it's been extremely difficult to find those figures. But I did recently discover, by looking at some objects in our collection, that in 1940, over 80 cyclists were killed in New South Wales alone in that year. Now, even allowing for the larger proportion of cyclists that were... This is the little book that I was looking at. Now, even allowing for the larger proportion of cyclists that were active in those days, the population of New South Wales was obviously much smaller and there were far fewer cars, so it was clear that something dramatic was going on. Now, this little publication is quite interesting because it largely sets out the road rules, but within it are numerous comments about the ensuing clash between bikes and cars, and the responsibility for those collisions was laid very firmly on the backs of the bicyclists. It was, in fact, a polite warning that they needed to learn to control their bicycles, that the age of the motor car had arrived and they'd better watch out. So I think assessing the place of the bicycle in Australian life can't really be complete unless we explore something about the arrival of car culture in Australia. And I think we have been culturally conditioned, really from this very early period in the 1940s, to see the car as somehow a natural and obvious advance on the bicycle. This is a kind of technological determinism. We simply accept the next piece of technology and reject all that went before it. So why did the motor car exert such a profound influence, rendering the bicycle a seemingly anachronistic curiosity, a relic of the previous century? Well, one reason, I suggest, can be found in the broader cultural changes that came in the mid-20th century. A term that scholars and cultural theorists use is the idea of the cultural imaginary. These are the images, words, literature, advertisements, language, and behaviours that support a particular way of life or a dominant behaviour. As I said earlier, cycling had been supported by a whole array of cultural practices, advertising, sporting events, stories, and, of course, everyday behaviour. So too has car culture. The dominance of cars in Australia is not somehow natural. It was supported by a complex range of factors. But it was also triggered and supported and sustained by an extraordinarily sophisticated rate of commercial and cultural products. And I think we can see today that we are surrounded by images that speak to the rightfulness, power, and legitimacy of the car on our streets. Where did it all start? Now, here I've drawn on some work done by a colleague of mine at the University of Canberra, Professor Angelina Rousseau. And she suggested that a key moment in the arrival of car culture in the 20th century came in New York. Now, this is a great example of the kind of cultural frameworks that developed in the mid-20th century, and cars were central to this particular vision that was advanced in this world fair. Perhaps it's unsurprising, given, as you can see, that the world fair was sponsored by General Motors. But at this world fair, there was a particular vision of the world that was being promoted. It was sleek, efficient, clean. It was also divorced from the natural world, making mankind a passive but also a master of their domain. And you can see, actually, the people, it was enormous models were created to map out this particular vision of the world. And you can see the people sitting on these lines of seats. They were actually motorised. You didn't, in fact, have to walk to explore this world. You sat and observed it passively, and like a train, it moved you around this fabulous world. So in this world, science and technology would do the work, would keep us alive. It was very much, I think, we didn't see much of this kind of thing in that vision. All the traffic was very free-flying and effective. But the vision, I think, reared up again in the 1960s with the Jetsons. Again, this is a hermetically sealed, labour-free environment. George Jetson, he didn't even have to brush his own teeth. So human power, I think, was redefined as backward, unnecessary, and a marker, if not of poverty, but certainly of lower class. And waiting for public transport or being slow, labouring over a bicycle, is not what we expect in a modern Western society. If you take a look at any car ad, I think they revel in a fantasy that the car opens pathways, seemingly uses very few resources, and doesn't require a vast and expensive infrastructure that has become central to our economies. So my point is that cultural meanings are critical to the way we see objects, the way we understand them. The kind of thoughts people have when they see certain objects are shaped by broader cultural values and conditioning. And in some ways, we still live in a technologically elitist culture. We do look to science and technology to deliver solutions to all manner of problems. The vision that was propounded at the New York World Fair, I think, in many ways, is still with us. And we do have this expectation of continuous technological improvement, and that, again, the older technologies are simply cast aside. I've got a couple of examples of car culture. These are from Holden, who were, I think, one of the best makers of commercial car advertising in Australia. From the terrific Sandman advertisements from the 1970s, which definitely, you know, embraced a kind of local identity, local Australian cultural identity, and associated that with the car. But more recently, they're moving to a more generic, but I think equally powerful kind of advertising. This one I think is particularly fascinating because the car seems to have disappeared. It's this sort of godlike vision, this ray of light appearing over the horizon. It's like a cosmic apparition, I don't know. But again, it feeds into all these very seductive fantasies about car travel. So what chance for the bicycle in all of this? The bike, it's materially and culturally anchored in the 19th century. So I don't think it's fared particularly well. Representations usually follow a certain pattern. If the bicycle is used by a professional sports person, it's generally considered quite a legitimate expression of bike usage. But often we see bicyclists defined in ways like this. They're either geeky individualists who are unable to really function as adults, probably virgins. I don't know if you've seen this film, The 40-Year-Old Virgin, which is a fabulous film, except for its presentation of the principal character as a cyclist. And, you know, often I notice when I'm watching TV or looking at mainstream movies, there's always some kind of jab at people who don't drive. And in this film, the filmmakers indicate the main character's incompetence at being an adult, along with his virginity and his penchant for collecting toys through the fact that he rides a bicycle. But I think Australia's contribution is probably better than all these. This is the... it was only from a couple of years ago, I think, from South Australia, their campaign to reduce the number of people drink driving. This, of course, it doesn't get any worse when you're forced to ride your bicycle. So I think it's amazing to me that people can be tainted and defined by their mode of transportation. And on a serious note, I think this can result in a kind of dehumanisation. And I'm not the only one, I'm sure, in this room who bristles at reports on the news that the death of a cyclist as simply an accident, or that cyclist has collided with motor vehicle. The power dynamics are reflected in this language, and the death is somehow an acceptable part of mixing the outdated, inferior technology with the fast and the modern. Okay, I'll take a slightly lighter note now with another contemporary example. And I'm going to go out on a limb and try and defend mammals, middle-aged men in Lycra. Now, I'm going to try and defend them, not because I think the kind of over-competitive behaviour is, you know, out of place and rude and occasionally dangerous, but I think the term is another in a long history of language that is used to put cyclists in their place. The phenomenon of the mammal has occurred for a few reasons. One of them is simply demographic. You've got large numbers of men and women who've reached a certain age. They're dealing with health issues, weight control. Cycling, of course, is now embraced as a great solution to those. Cycling, it's always been a commercial and image-driven industry, so it's also a great way to show off your social status, your financial status, and perhaps assert something of a fading physicality. But what I really mind is that, by and large, it's a bloke attempting to get fit and perhaps not looking to just keep working and eating their way into an early heart attack. Ridiculing them is another way of saying that they should get back in their box, follow normal social patterns and not assert their physicality. And this, I think, has a clear historical parallel. Female cyclists were similarly attacked and vilified for daring to challenge the social acceptable social mores. They were lampooned as fast women, modern women, and much worse. They were ridiculed for dressing like a man, risking their fertility and their very womanhood for daring to get out on a bicycle in what they called then was rational clothing. Rational clothing, of course, was the Lycra of the 19th century. But my point here is that there's a language is a huge signifier of what is normal and it's used to control behaviour. And it's been critically important in shaping perceptions of cycling and its place in society. Of course, women continued to face these challenges into the 1960s and 70s. During my research for the Freewheeling exhibition, I spoke to a lady called Margaret McLaughlin. And she began riding, there's Margaret there, in the 1960s. And she was a great talent in the 60s and started winning scratch races against the men of her club in Dulwich Hill in Sydney. And when she organised a women's only race, the blokes from the club all dressed up as women with wigs and participated in a mock race in order to ridicule their female counterparts. And in 1966, McLaughlin became the first Australian woman ever to be granted an open racing licence, enabling her to compete in official events. A year later, the New South Wales Amateur Cycling Union revoked her licence without explanation, but presumably because she was winning, and she was again restricted to club races. So seeking to be recognised as a serious cyclist, she had to take to doing long-distance riding, which women had been doing since the late 19th century, and she broke Joyce Barry's almost 30-year Sydney to Melbourne record, which I believe it still stands today. So I think we've come a long way on that front, but although for the profile of women cycling, there's still a lot of a long way to catch up. So what are the hot-button issues for cyclists today that we see in the media? Cyclists break the road rules, they run red lights, obstruct the traffic, injure pedestrians, they're unlicensed and don't pay registration. It's really the family feud state of affairs. The actions of a few are used to define a larger group. And I've been struggling to sort of unpack and understand why this has been occurring. Cyclists, it seems, are still one of the few groups still vulnerable to overgeneralising and stereotyping. They're vulnerable to the demonising tactics that have been employed for forever to attack all manner of groups, welfare recipients, Asian drivers, corrupt politicians, Muslims or any other ethnic national group you can think of. Something makes it okay to speak about this group in a way that would be unimaginable in describing a profession, ethnic or gender group. It's a tough problem, but I think some clues can be found in areas that I've already canvassed, particularly the embrace of technological and mechanised progress. A person on a bicycle can be portrayed as outmoded and irresponsible as someone taking their donkey-drawn cart down a highway. It's an annoying anachronism. It impedes the lives of busy working people. As a mode of transport, it therefore lacks cultural legitimacy and is not deemed worthy of respect. The danger argument is a little bit more perplexing. Speeding bikes seem to produce an inordinate amount of fear and anger. The real killer, of course, is all around us. The car is speeding around us and our children every day. The road toll is in the thousands. Around 40 pedestrians are killed every year by cars. But we've become immune to the grim reality of car driving. We're conditioned to accept it as normal, safe and natural. Hundreds of thousands of drivers get speeding fines. The courts are full of people charged with DUI offences. But we've been conditioned, I think, since infancy, really, to ignore fatalities, to normalise and dismiss traffic violations. Car dominance has become the devil we know. Yet, if a cyclist goes through a red light, this happens. It's the end of civilisation. This was actually a response to the kind of disproportionate responses that were popping up in the media in the UK, and these signs were put up all over London. So by contrast, it seems that the vision of a human body pedalling a bicycle dressed with less protection than a pair of pyjamas, easily producing speeds of over 25, 30 kilometres an hour, is as unsettling as it was 100 years ago. There were huge debates in the 1890s about cyclists knocking down, kind of upsetting the pattern of city life, that it was unnatural to move at such a speed. So in the last part of my talk, I want to suggest a new way forward, a way we can counter the aggressive, negative stereotyping and how we can begin to redress the imbalance and modify our obsession with private motor transport. And in some ways, it might be helpful to think about generating or perhaps rediscovering the cycling imaginary that sustained bicycle culture for over 50 years in the early 20th century. So what might this cycling imaginary look like? When you think about it, riding a bicycle is an almost universal experience. Except for countries suffering extreme poverty, almost every child learns to ride a bike. In the Western world, it's deemed a rite of passage. It's something we graduate from into our car-driving adulthood. The bicycle and all its freedoms are then relegated to a childhood nostalgia. And unless we get back into it, we can often associate cycling, or just not driving in general, with a kind of adolescence. But we know that the rates of children riding to school are particularly low at the present time. And of course here we see a similar pattern of uncertainty, the perception that the journey is too far, it's too dangerous, there's too many cars and the individual is too exposed by riding their bicycle. Some communities in Australia have countered in really creative ways, like with things like the cycle bus, which involves a group cycling around and collecting children on their way to school so they can ride together. It's also important, I think, to support this idea of a cycling imaginary with better research and data. As I mentioned with my struggle to find statistics about cycling fatalities, we have there's a real dearth of good quality analysis and statistics about cycling. And this, in fact, plays back into the cycle where politicians and developers who can cite, well, low participation rates as a reason for not adopting active transport policies and not adapting their designs to take into account pedestrians and cyclists. So good information, I think, is very helpful in breaking these stereotypes. Forthright advertising campaigns and techniques, just as they were used early in the 20th century, I think are also important. We might co-opt the strategies that have been used to sustain car culture for decades in order to propagate a different vision of the world. Now, this next thing I'm going to show you is, you have to forgive the slight digression from cycling, but I haven't been able to find a better example of a very artful way of changing a dominant transport patterns. And it's from Denmark, of course.
Mit Trafik präsentiert. Mit Trafik. Vi skal nok køre dig.
It is fantastic, isn't it? There is a sequel to that, but I'll leave you to find that one yourself. But in the sequel, it's a little bit more radical. There's a fellow actually torching his car in order to take the bus. I think these kind of things are absolutely fabulous, and I'd love to see them in Australia. But I think we may be a little way off that yet. So another component, I think, of the cycling imaginary is tradition. The great cycling cultures of the world, like the Danes, are supported by much more than good infrastructure. They have a deep sense of the virtue and significance of their cycling histories. This image is of the Eddy Merckx metro station in Brussels. Once you get over the slightly weird fact that the metro station is named after a cyclist, it was fascinating to me that millions of people were walking past this bicycle who's from an absolute icon of world cycling, and it remains ungraffitied. It is an object of reverence in Belgium. The bicycle was actually used by Eddy Merckx to break the 1967 world hour record, he's an absolute national hero in Belgium. Now the museum's freewheeling exhibition, at least when I was thinking of it, I wanted it to be inspired by a kind of celebration of the Australian cycling tradition. This is an image of the exhibition as it is in Brisbane. It explores different modes of riding, but also explores how others in the past have searched for the same kind of engagement with the world around them that many of us are seeking today. It traces our rich cycling traditions, which I would argue are as rich as Europe's, and this is probably a controversial thing to say, but I think we have tended to suffer a bit of amnesia, and one of the purposes of this exhibition was to reconnect people with that history and remind them that Australia, in fact, has a very long history of racing as well. And the Melbourne to Warrnambool race is, in fact, the second oldest one-day classic in the world. The only older race is the Liège-Bastogne-Liège, which is in Belgium. But I don't think those kind of things are very well widely understood. So for me, this show reminds Australians that cycling is not a recent phenomenon. It's not a fad or a minority activity that will peter out and go away. It reminds us that Australia has always had a vibrant cycling culture and is very much a part of our history as much as football and cricket. Perhaps even more importantly, it's an activity that intersects with the major cultural and political challenges of our time. It affects the way our nations are represented overseas, our approach to improving national health, how our cities are designed, and how we respond to climate change. And I think this is why museums can play a critical role in shaping these ideas and facilitating a vibrant and informed debate. Now, another dimension to the cycling imaginary that I've been outlining is architecture. Another colleague of mine, Stephen Fleming, who is an architect at the University of Tasmania, takes his inspiration from the act of cycling in his designs. Now, he looks at particular cycling modes and then attempts to develop forms and building shapes that actually respond to those. So here he's got the idea of the velodrome, that actually cycling up gentle inclines might be a way of building a way of living that actually directly embraces the bicycle, not sees it as an adjunct to design. So here he's taken this concept of the velodrome and turned it into this an apartment block, which you can actually cycle to the top of. At first, though, you think this is a utopian fantasy, but again, as we turn back to Denmark, they've already built one. This is known as House 8. It's 8 stories high, and you can actually cycle up or down to the very top. It has a lift, of course, so you can take the lift up to the top. When you're leaving for the day, you can actually go down this series of aerial streets and down to the bottom, which is then it's connected by metro to Copenhagen City, or it's a 15-minute bike ride. Another image of it there being constructed. This is another development that's taking place at the moment in Minneapolis in the United States. It's known as the Midtown Greenway. It's actually a disused rail corridor that bisects the city, and it's been turned into, you can see, a double-lane bicycle path with also a pedestrian path as well. And it's actually it's become a real focal point for developers who are then, you know, responding to the usage of this particular area, building. Not quite as radical as Denmark, but equally they're building townhouses and so forth that will then, you know, make this a very vibrant part of town. I think another thing that we perhaps should be asking questions about and encouraging a more widely understood perspective of is the subsidies that are offered for car usage. In most countries around the world, most workers can salary sacrifice to purchase a car. Business kilometres are tax deductible. I think this does reinforce a driving culture. It also deprives the government of revenue. But I think, you know, those things are not really spoken about in our political debates. In 2004, actually, the UK government introduced a salary sacrificing option for people to purchase a bicycle, which was, I think, was a major step forward. The French government have been trialling a system where cyclists are paid per kilometre to ride to work, which, you know, that would be a fantastic thing to see here. Now, I'm not really outlining a comprehensive blueprint for change, but I think we can see that a culture that privileges cycling and pedestrian public transport and moderates the use of the car will need to be a blend of cultural imagery, history, social programs, economic incentives, new architecture, cycling infrastructure, commercial strategies, and education. And just in summing up my argument today, the bicycle has fascinated me as an object for a long time. And as I said at the beginning, it's a complex and paradoxical object. It contains many links to our past, but also to our future. And at the centre of all our debates that we're having, the contentious debates that we're having today, I think there is a nagging question about how we imagine our physical lives. The seductive mid-century fantasies of a world without labour is still with us. The working body seems to clash with the fundamental concern of the modern world to make machines and science do the work, to protect us from exertion and fatigue. Yet it seems that those machines and the kind of resource consumption and passivity they have enabled may in fact be endangering our very existence, not sustaining it. But perhaps as we continue to reconnect with the bicycle, and I think we can see this happening not just in Australia but certainly around the world, we might finally grow restful with the bicycle and our own bodies. As transgressive as the bicycle has been, it has also been one of the most resilient devices. Over 150 years, the basic principle and design haven't fundamentally changed. The kind of experience we look for on our bikes would be immediately recognisable to our cycling ancestors. Bicycles are symbols of freedom and hope today, just as they were 100 years ago, and especially for women in the 1890s. They are such adaptable and resilient symbols, I think, because they're fundamentally an extension of ourselves. It's a simple mechanism designed to amplify our own capacities and experiences, and it does that in extraordinarily diverse and poetic ways. So given the entrenched nature of Australia's car culture, the extraordinary resurgence of cycling that we are seeing in recent decades is perhaps even more remarkable, and I think this should be celebrated. The rediscovery, or normalisation of the bicycle, if you will, is already underway. And importantly, using a bicycle allows us to rediscover our physicality and our place as part of the natural world, not somehow outside of it. And I can't really think of another device that is more appropriate to many of the challenges of our time. Thanks for listening.
Thank you very much, Daniel. We've got some time for questions if anybody would like to ask Daniel anything about his talk.
Thanks, Daniel. That was a very interesting talk. And there's one point that I wanted to make about the photo of the exhibition in Brisbane. It's got heaps of people in it.
Fantastic.
It looked empty when you had the photograph, of course. The question I wanted was, going back to the 1940s road transport booklet, that was actually saying that that the onus was on the bicycle to avoid the car, was it? That's the first example that you can find that it was officially sanctioned to, or trying to make that change to, in favour of the car?
Absolutely, yeah. It's quite unambiguous, really. There's little stories there about, you know, the cyclists who've wobbled across the road and into the path of cars. So it's absolutely that kind of framework which puts that responsibility on the cyclist to kind of get out of the way. Whether it's the earliest, I'm not sure. As I've really struggled to kind of find, statistical evidence of what was happening, particularly sort of in the 1950s and 60s, when I think there was a really big shift. And, you know, of course, the car road toll in the 60s and 70s was at the peak. It was about nearly, I think, 2 to 3 times what it is today. And I'm surmising that had a pretty devastating effect on the amount of cycling that was going on.
Thank you very much, Daniel. A fascinating history of cycling in Australia and thoroughly enjoyable. Just a quick comment and then possibly a question. My wife and I have just returned from 3 years living and working in Denmark, in Copenhagen. Fabulous place to live and work. We couldn't afford a car when we were living there because the tax on cars was 180%. So a $30,000 Kia would cost you $88,000 or so in Denmark, and then add a few bucks a litre for petrol, you can't really afford to run it. So we rode our bikes for transport, for commuting, and got hooked on cycling. What I was interested in as I became more and more fanatical about cycling was that in the 1970s, Australia and Denmark had roughly the same participation rates in cycling, roughly about 35% cycling participation. And in Australia, a lot of that was kids riding to school. As both Denmark and Australia wanted to sort of look after people who were cycling, Denmark looked and tried to create separated infrastructure for cyclists to protect cyclists. In Australia, we went the other way. We asked the cyclists to be entirely responsible for their safety by mandating that they wear helmets and high visibility gear. And as a result, especially once mandatory helmet laws came into effect in the early 90s, cycling participation plummeted, especially for those people who just were jumping on it to go from point A to point B, not necessarily those mammals who were using it for recreation. So I just wonder where do you see cycling participation in? Of course, it's a complex subject, but in terms of building cycling participation in Australia for just general mode share, where it's urban design, of course, but what other possible things Australia might do?
Yeah, no, great comment. It's, as a friend of mine says, that in the 70s, Europe got bike paths. In Australia, we got helmets. And that, in some ways, you know, sums up the level of concern there was in this country. In terms of, again, it's what I come back to. It's this. It's changing that cultural framework, which is incredibly difficult. Someone did point out to me, and I've cycled to it in Belgium and France myself, and they said, well, you know, when you get out of the cities, there isn't the infrastructure, which is very true. But as I said, well, what actually is different is the way people approach you, or the way they see you on your bicycle. So you don't often experience the same kind of fear. You certainly don't get the same amount of aggression and hostility. That I think is, you know, is the first step. In Australia, we probably need, you know, an outbreak of civility on these kind of issues, but actually affecting it, I think, will take a long time. One thing I think that can kind of change that perception is actually seeing more people on bikes. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that breaks stereotypes, is when people actually see, you know, experience one-on-one people riding. So, you know, you see a lot of, you know, bicycle advocates get very excited about big group events when they close down streets and everyone comes out on their bikes. And we're seeing that happening in, you know, a lot of places in Europe, but also in places like Colombia, in Bogota and Medellin, are cities that have, because they've essentially ground to a halt, they said, well, they've had to do something. So they have, you know, the Ciclovis days on Sundays, where they shut the streets, everyone comes out on their bicycles. Those kind of cultural events, I think, have the potential to be really powerful in kind of breaking that cycle and getting people to, you know, think differently. But it's a long-term strategy. But if you think we've only had, well, you'd say, sort of mass car ownership for 60 years, that's not really a long time. You know, it may take that long to change it again, to change it back.
But thank you very much for a very stimulating presentation. I hope will be widely seen. And But going further in terms of possible, you have only just shown recumbents, and there's quite a bit of discussion about those, and the going into, for older people in particular, electric bicycles, and I wondered whether you might like to, and the possible directions technologically that one might be going in the future. Using the bicycle as a means of transport.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned electric bikes, because I think that there is something of a tension within the cycling community about electric bikes. I think we're still kind of trying to understand what they mean, because there's sort of there's an introduction of a technological component, a motorised, mechanised component that we haven't really associated with bicycles. It's been all about, you know, human power. So it's going to be interesting how that develops. I don't really know. I think, again, part of it's about speed. I was actually, when I rode to work yesterday, I was overtaken by a guy going about 60 kilometres an hour on his homemade, it must be said, electric bicycle. At that moment, I thought, oh, I'm on a road, and this is a motorbike. Something about it sort of changed it in my mind. So, you know, I'm still wrestling with that. I guess the thing I would say, I mean, I'm a recumbent bike rider myself, amongst other machines. I really encourage the kind of diversity in bicycles, and that's, again, part of, I think, you know, breaking down that there's a, you know, a particular way to ride a bike. And I think, you know, there's certainly a tension between, say, your sports racing cyclists and recumbents. You know, there's a bit of a tension there. I like to, you know, make fun of the recumbent riders because it's different. But I think that's the diversity and the kind of thing we should be celebrating, which encourages people to see this activity as not, you know, they don't have to be a certain way to engage in it, that there is an element of it that we can all respond to. But
Daniel, following on from the freewheeling exhibition, I haven't seen it in many years, but there used to be a wonderful bike exhibition at the Tradies in Dixon, including that Butte Fantasy bike.
Indeed. It was a sad day when the Bicycle Museum closed down. We actually acquired a couple of bikes from that collection. You probably don't know that actually nearly half that collection ended up with a bicycle collector in Toowoomba, who he actually raised his house in order to create space underneath it for this collection of bicycles. I went up and sadly he passed away last year, but I went up and saw him. And there's a little film, a terrific little film made about James McDonald on YouTube, which you can find. But yeah, wouldn't it be great? Bicycle museum.
A question about cycle touring, especially organised touring. You mentioned a few people who did long distance tours on their bicycles, but today I think there's quite an industry in cycle touring, at least in Europe, I believe, and in New Zealand especially too, where and they're not just one-off events, but you can, you know, book a tour on, and they'll arrange your bicycle for you, your transport your goods and things from A to B. And has that been a part of Australia's history too?
You mean in terms of sort of an organised
mode? Companies that and are there routes or in Australia where these people, you know, overseas visitors or locals can take bike rides together?
Yeah, it's as I was saying, that those kind of developments have been huge in Australia. Really, I think probably in the last decade or so, there's tours that you can take, you know, across the Nullarbor, around the country. You know, that's been, you know, a huge growth area. And I often think about that when people look at statistics, which are usually poorly compiled, about cycling participation to work. And I say, well, it's only a minority. You know, that doesn't really reflect the growth. But those kind of industries, yeah, are absolutely having, I think, a profound effect on cycling participation. You can almost go anywhere now on an organised cycling tour. You know, there's one, you know, there's cross continents. There's the tour to Africa, which is an organised tour. You can ride from Cairo to Cape Town. And similarly, there's one that goes around Australia. So it's terrific to see. But it is part of a longer tradition of people in Australia just getting out there with far less, it must be said.
Daniel, thanks for your talk. And as others have said, it was stimulating. I'd like to give you some feedback on one of those little bits of stimulation. And one was the stability of the design and how good it is. And to me, that means something for trying to develop sustainable lifestyles. If we've got a sustainable design that's been approved over 100 years or so, maybe we can build on that. And my favourite bicycle would be one with a titanium frame. And the objections to it is if design changes or fashions change, you don't want to spend that much money. But if we could build in real sustainability into bicycle design and recycling of bits and pieces from ones that fall apart for one reason or another, titanium might be worth thinking of as a good input into that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the sort of interesting things about the bicycle, certainly about its image, is of being sustainable and you know, all these kind of positive values. But you know, often, you know, we need to look at where those bikes are produced. And you know, often they're produced by far less sustainable methods, and particularly if they're coming out of poorer countries with, you know, lower regulations around, you know, labour and environmental standards, the bicycle might not quite look like the kind of, you know, symbolic projection that it's looking to project. I say we should explore all those kind of technologies with bicycle design. But as you say, the essence of it is a classic.
Hi there. My question's about gender and cycling. Just a comment first on the fact that cycling, the machine itself, has changed very little over the years. I'd actually like a few changes. My black hands today testify why I'm late. I'm not very good at maintaining my bike. I'm not very skilled at it. And today the chain broke on the way to an Is Cycling Normal seminar, which is rather tragic, and we had to come here by car. I would love a bike. I hate changing the tyres. I find it really tedious. So I'd love someone to make a bike that's much easier to fix. But I'm aware that of the, it was about 4,600 people who cycle to work on census day, and of those, 28% of them are women. So women are less likely to cycle in Australia. And I think you've covered very well some of the reasons why that will be, the, you know, the issues of physicality and culture and so on. Do you have any other kind of tips of how we can start to enhance the participation of women in cycling?
Well, I think part of it is just, is as you say, it's addressing those kind of addressing the factors that, that stop people from doing it. And one of the ones that people cite in surveys is fear. I'm less convinced by the argument that it's because, and this is a terribly sexist argument, that it's because women have to wear a helmet, which you do often. That does bubble up from time to time. I think there's much more substantive reasons why women in particular. And it is that the, a belief that they are more vulnerable on a bicycle, and if as things like you've just experienced, like your chain breaking, you know, what do you do? I'll harken back to a historical example. When bicycles, you know, first started taking off, you know, in every town and country there was a blacksmith that, that doubled as a bicycle shop. So there was a tremendous array of kind of services, and people did, even though they were covering big distances, they didn't actually feel as vulnerable as we might feel today, because there was this, this broader framework that supported their activities. So whether that, you know, is something that, that hopefully will develop, so there isn't that sense of isolation that, you know, if I don't know how to break a chain, I'm not going to get on my bike. Maybe there needs to be like an NRMA, but for bicycles, RMA or something like that. I think that there's all sorts of ways we could develop.
I'm interested in your ideas on normalising bicycle culture, and I noticed in Europe you often see men and women of all ages and in street clothes cycling quite regularly. And I wonder if the bicycle industry itself here in Australia is part of the problem, because they're marketing gear to gear freaks, and so the mammal syndrome are actually men who like buying snazzy gear and expensive equipment and the latest thing, and so that image that they present is not of normal people using bicycles, it's of high-tech sports people, you know, demonstrating their prowess, and the cycling industry actually benefits from that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we haven't... We're a long way from where we were, 100 years ago, when I think there was a much more sophisticated trade in kind of how you dressed for cycling. And in some ways, it came out of the debate about women, about what they should be wearing. But it did lead to lots of niche markets about what you would wear, you know, the particular gloves, what they were made out of. You know, it was really quite sophisticated. And you're right. And I think we've seen a huge growth in interest in sports cycling, the Tour de France and the Cadel Evans Factor and all these kind of things. But I think that is, in some ways, it's fantastic. But it has encouraged commercial operations to say, well, that's what people must want. They must want to look like all these cycling heroes, when, of course, the rest of us know that that's not the case, that we don't want to ride like, you know, moving billboards. We want other options. And if, I know for myself, because I, you know, object to wearing heavily advertising products and so on, that I'm often looking overseas. That's where we're going. So, you know, maybe the market will respond as things improve. I hope so. Francis,
this will be the last question, and then please join us back in the Friends Lounge and we can continue to debate this. Likewise, if you've got suggestions about more talks like this, please talk to either Daniel or I, and we'll organise some more for you.
Thanks, Daniel. I hope these talks continue. One of the comments about cycling and sustainability for me when I was commuting to work was being able to shower when I got there, because it was 20k up and down hills, and so that made a big difference for me in the workplace, and that's maybe something that developers could think about when they're designing office works. But also on a personal level, I have, now I'm retired, I do the Thawa Loop occasionally, 40k door-to-door for me, and I make a point of waving to every car once I'm out of Tuggeranong and on the country roads, and it's amazing how many now are waving back. I don't do it at a regular time or a regular day, but trying to humanise the interaction between me and the tradies and the four-wheel drive farmers and, you know, trucks and things like that, and they really do wave back, which is great.
I do exactly the same thing. But I waved. I can see them in my rearview mirror, and I waved to them before they'd come to me.
Well, look, thank you again. Could you please join me in thanking Daniel and join us down in the Friends Lounge?
Thank you. Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.